My dream was just to be a writer, to teach, to do both. And eventually I made that happen, but boy, it was really tough for a long time, which is why my memoir is titled Crying in the Bathroom.
That's writer and 2019 NEA Lit Fellow, Erica L. Sanchez. And this is Artworks, the weekly podcast produced by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. It's fair to say that 2017 was a banner year for writer Erica L. Sanchez. Her debut collection of poetry, Lessons on Expulsion, was published in July of that year, and it received praise from many publications, including The Washington Post and The New York Times. And things just kept getting better. In October, her YA novel, I'm Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter, was also published. This novel traces a pivotal year in the life of a teenager who, like Sanchez herself, is the daughter of Mexican immigrants living in Chicago, where money is tight and generational and cultural tensions abound. To say the book was well-received is an understatement. I'm Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter was a finalist for the National Book Award. In fact, the book was nominated before it even hit the bookstores. Erica Sanchez remembers that moment.
It was pretty surreal. I didn't even anticipate that coming whatsoever. It was such a surprise for me since it wasn't actually out and I didn't even know it was a possibility. So it was some of the best news I've ever gotten in my life, to be quite honest. And then waiting to hear if I made the shortlist, that was another few weeks of anticipation. I was extremely nervous, and yeah, it was one of the best nights of my life. And I feel bad for everybody who can't actually celebrate this year in person. And so I'm just so lucky that it happened when we didn't have a pandemic.
Yeah, exactly right. Because you had a hell of a year that year. Your book of poetry came out and your YA novel. And I was actually thinking about that as I was preparing for this. You were just going around the country. You were going everywhere. And that just wouldn't be possible now.
No, I'm just relieved that it came out that year. And I was incredibly busy. I was all over the place. I didn't know where I was waking up half the time. And that was like a really special time for me, you know, getting to connect with people in real life. And it's surreal to have to resort to all of these other methods that don't feel organic at all. I just really look forward to when this is over. This has been very hard for me. Just as a person who really likes to connect on a personal, genuine level.
Yeah, I bet. It's hard for all of us.
Yeah.
This actually takes me straight into your YA novel, which is about a 15-year-old girl. And the one thing I am so conscious of during this time is being so grateful that I am not 15. I would have lost my mind.
Yeah.
It's very different when you're on shutdown, but it's your own home. And you can sort of make the life that you want to, as opposed to being 15, where you're totally being controlled by somebody else.
Yeah, no, I feel the same way. Completely.
Tell me why you decided to write a YA novel.
Well, you know, at that age, I had so many different challenges. I felt incredibly depressed, but I didn't know that's what it was. I didn't know what to call it. And I felt very lonely and disconnected from everybody. And had I been in a lockdown during that time, I just don't know how I would have survived it, because my home wasn't my haven. I felt very misunderstood. I felt like really scrutinized in my own house. And so, yeah, I thank God that I'm an adult and I could do whatever I want now. But oh man, that was a tough age. And I felt like I needed to write the novel that I needed at that age and that I know other girls need as well, because it's just really isolating. And there's not a lot of literature that really represents the Mexican American immigrant child experience.
Can you just tell us a little bit about the plot of the book, I'm Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter, which kind of sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And so it surprises me when people are like, oh, she's so unlikable, or I can't stand this protagonist. And it's like, well, it kind of tells you right away that she's not going to be perfect, and she might be a challenge. So she's 15 years old. Her name is Julia. She lives on the south side of Chicago in a not specified neighborhood, but it's very Mexican and working class. And she's grappling with being a teenager. And also her sister dies right at the beginning of the book. And so she is dealing with this loss, and she is trying to figure out who she is. And her parents don't understand her. She doesn't really understand them. And so she's on this quest to like learn more about her sister. And in that process, she learns a whole lot about herself and her family.
Well, you know, we learn a few things about her immediately, her sister dying unexpectedly. But we also learn she's an avid reader and writer, and it's really the core of who she is. But what I really appreciated was that it's her own agency. She has a helpful teacher, but he's peripheral. He's not the one who opened the world of writing to her, which often happens. You know, she's already in it, and that is so rare.
Yeah, I thought that was really important. I wanted her to have a lot of agency despite her limitations, right? She is up against a whole lot of boundaries, and she breaks them often. And so, I mean, that was pretty much who I was at that age. And, you know, it's fiction, and of course, a lot of things are imagined. But at that age of 15, I was just so in love with writing and literature, and it was all I ever wanted to do with my life. And it's not something that we often see in books and media, like a young, poor Mexican girl wanting a life in art of some kind. It's not something that's actively encouraged a lot of the time. And her teacher does encourage her in many ways, but she is also very, very self-motivated, despite what the world may think of her plans.
And as you mentioned, she's first generation, the daughter of Mexican immigrants, as you are. How does that inform her?
Well, for a lot of Mexican American young people, there's this double life that you must live, where you're immersed at home in a very traditional culture, oftentimes a culture that is in some ways in conflict with our American culture. And so it's really confusing. And there's a lot of guilt also, because for many of us, our parents are like working in factories, just like blue collar work, and like really sacrificing a lot so that their children could be more comfortable than they would be in Mexico. And so there's just this sense of obligation that we often feel, but for many of us, also a sense of rebellion that, you know, we don't really quite fit into those expectations that they have because we grew up in completely different environments. And so there's just, there are a lot of conflicts there.
What I always find interesting in literature that explores the experience of first generation kids is that first generation kids look at their parents as being traditional and old fashioned. Then as they grow up, they sort of have this moment of realizing what their parents did, picking up and leaving their country and moving someplace else. And it's really hard for them to comprehend the audacity of that.
Right. Yeah. And I wanted to show that the, you know, the character doesn't quite understand her parents in so many different ways. And she, you know, she's a self-centered 15-year-old girl. And I think that's the age where you're very, very much obsessed with your own self. And you can't really see outside of you. And so I wanted to show that, like, her parents didn't understand her, but she also didn't understand her parents, who, yes, uprooted their entire lives and moved to a completely different country and are living like very difficult circumstances. They have to work really hard. They don't speak the language well. Their daughter is very much Americanized. And so how do they cope? How do they react to that? And in the novel, the mother is extremely repressive. And I think that's just her way of trying to protect her kid, not knowing that it's causing her a great deal of damage.
No, agreed. And, you know, there's that lack of privacy also that you have when you're 15, when privacy is so important.
Right. Yeah, we don't believe in that in a Mexican household.
But it's, I think it's also a hallmark of poverty because, you know, when you're poor, there's no space to be private. Where are you going to be private?
Right. You don't have often your own room. Like everyone's just kind of crowded together. Yeah, it's tough.
Chicago has a role in the book, which I really appreciate. I like books that are tied to place. Tell me how Chicago factors into your book.
Yeah, I love Chicago. I grew up in Cicero, which is right on the border of Chicago. You know, I would walk a block and I was in the city. And so it was very much a Chicago experience. And I was always trying to escape my home in some way by like wandering through the city, discovering new places and trying to find people who were like me. And I spent a lot of time just like alone, you know, going to the museums and pondering on the CTA and things like that. And so I wanted to celebrate that part of my upbringing. I loved doing those kinds of things. And I feel like really lucky that I had access to so many different places. The Art Institute, it's a world-renowned institution, and I got to go and just spend afternoons there just because I felt like it. And like a lot of people don't have that opportunity, so I'm very grateful for that. And I have a lot of affection for the city, even though it's very challenging at times. It has a great deal of problems, but in general, it's a city that has given me a lot, and I wanted to just really highlight that. And I was very much also inspired by Catcher in the Rye, which is probably obvious to a lot of people, but that sort of sense of the wanderlust, not really having a plan, and but just wanting to find new things and feel excited and seen and, I don't know, a part of something bigger.
Yeah, yeah. We learn, as you mentioned in the course of the book, that Julia has mental health challenges, that she's depressed. And at the end of the book, you provide resources for people who have similar challenges. And I think this is perhaps a kind of cultural shading to it as well. It's still such a source of shame.
Yeah, it really is. And it's unfortunate that we have this stigma because it's an illness that no one chooses to have. It's still very silly to me to think that people judge others for struggling in this way. And I'm trying to break that down. And I'm hoping that the book opens a lot of doors for people to get help, because I didn't really have a lot of resources when I was growing up, and it was really hard and it felt lonely. And so Latina teens have the highest suicide rates of their peers. And so that's something that is often ignored or, I don't know, dismissed. I'm not sure. It's kind of mind-boggling to me because it's such a serious problem and no one really talks about it. And so I felt like it was my duty to bring it up and to, you know, examine it and to put it in the world and make it a conversation.
Well, you do a lot with secrets in that book. I mean, it really is a book of secrets, some of them generated by cultural expectations, but you develop this through the generations. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was trying to address the cultural trauma or the generational trauma that a lot of us carry that we don't often talk about. There's so much that we don't often know about the people who came before us. We, in some ways, carry those consequences for them. And so I wanted to unpack that what happens in previous generations still affects who we are now. You know, I think often about slavery and how it's always relevant, because it's something that was so horrific and it lasted for so long that like we can't forget about it. And that's why Toni Morrison wrote relentlessly about it. And so I wanted to do something similar, in which I approach these forms of oppression that have been happening for generations. And here's a 15-year-old girl in Chicago who is somehow dealing with those repercussions as well. And so like how do we cope with that as a people?
Yeah. Inherited trauma.
Yeah.
Your book of poetry, Lessons on Expulsion, came out the same year as the novel. I'm just so curious how getting two different manuscripts in two different genres ready for publication at the same time, what was that like?
Yeah, that was totally unexpected. I had been working on the manuscript for about 10 years and I was rejected time and time again. It was just an onslaught. And so I didn't know when it was going to happen. And I'm actually glad that it took so long, to be quite honest, because I feel like it was the best possible book that I could have published at that time. And it was just a crazy coincidence that both books were accepted. And it was pretty nerve-wracking in some ways, but really exciting mostly. The editing process for both books, it was pretty painless because I had such great editors and I've been blessed with that in my career, where the editorial process has been really enriching rather than demoralizing. I feel like the editors that I've had really understood how to make the book better. And I don't have much of an ego when it comes to that, like revisions. I also want to make the book the best it possibly could be. And if that means changing or cutting or what have you, then I will. I'm not very precious about that. I just want it to be excellent. It was mostly excitement, honestly. And once they were out in the world, it was just like a barrage of responsibilities. I had to go to so many different places and talk about my work. And it was a dream come true in many ways, but it was also incredibly exhausting. It's just so different now that we can't actually go anywhere. I'm just like, wait, what? Like, how did this happen? What a shift.
What a shift.
Some of the poems share themes with the novel, like define cultural norms, and also both look at people on borders. We've talked about cultural norms. Let's talk about borders and the significance of borders in your work.
Sure. Yeah, well, borders to me have always been something that are very real, tangible, physical, because my parents immigrated in the late 70s and they crossed the border with the help of a coyote. It was a story that I was quite familiar with, and it was something that I heard about very, very frequently. And not just their story, but the stories of other people in our family and our community. So I very much understood that borders meant that certain people weren't allowed in our country. And I just felt like that was such an injustice to deny people the right to be in a place. And so growing up, it was something that I thought often about. And then as I grew older, there were so many other iterations of borders in my life as a young woman of color, like what I was allowed to do, what I was not allowed to do. And so I became in many ways very defiant when it came to boundaries and borders. And so I continue to be very, very rebellious when it comes to limitations. And so, you know, I write about borders and there are many iterations in all of my writing. And I like to explore a lot of in-between places. And so that's another way that I like to examine borders. What does it mean to be on a border, to live in a space that isn't really one place or the other?
You know, I'm curious about the way you approach your poetry, and is it different than your approach to fiction?
Yeah, it totally is. Poetry for me is my first love, and it was something that I knew that I wanted to do as soon as I discovered it. And, you know, as a young girl from a working class environment, it just didn't make any sense to anyone that that's something that I would pursue. It's still looking back on it, it doesn't make sense. But it was something that I truly, truly loved. And it allowed me to explore like really mysterious places within myself and really like find a voice that I felt I didn't have anywhere else. And so that was really important for me. And my love of poetry is what makes my prose possible. I think the fact that I pay so much attention to detail, to image, to rhythm and things like that, like that's the reason that I think my prose has done well, is because these things all very much matter to me. So it's something that is like the foundation for everything that I do in my work. Poetry is often something that requires a lot of silence and contemplation and time. It's something that I never ever rush. And so my poetry collection took 10 years to write, and then this next one will probably take 10 years to write, and I'm totally okay with that. I'm just slower when it comes to poetry because I care so much about every single word. and I want every single poem to be excellent. And for me, that takes a long time. And you know, my prose takes a long time as well. It's just a different process. This next book that I've been working on, it's been 5 years of work. It probably won't come out until spring of 2022. So that's also going to take a long time, but it's not the same kind of like patience that I have with poetry. With poetry, is just, I don't know. So there's something very mystical about it.
I'm wondering what animates poetry for you. Is it a sound? Is it an image?
It's both. Oftentimes, like, I hear a word and I'm like, ooh, what's that? Why is that conjuring feelings? You know, I don't really understand, you know, or I'll see something in the world that really strikes me and I feel like haunted by it, and then I have to write about it at some point. And sometimes it takes me years to really return to that image, but it's something that I can't seem to forget. It has to somehow manifest itself in a poem. Yeah, it's something very special to me, and I just really love it. It brings me a lot of joy, and I'm so glad that I started writing poetry before anything else.
You write in Spanish in both your fiction and poetry without translating it.
Yeah.
And obviously, that's a choice. So walk us through that.
Sure. I think at this point in our society, in our culture, it's no longer necessary to translate something as ubiquitous as Spanish. Every author who is bilingual has that choice, whether to accommodate to those who don't know the language or not. And so I thought it was important not to call attention to itself, because in the novel, she's very much bilingual and she thinks in both languages and she speaks in both languages. And I wanted to show the fluidity of that without making it jarring and like being self-conscious about it. And I italicize also for that reason, because it's just like, that's who she is. And within context, it's pretty easy to understand, I believe. And I make it so that it's not completely foreign. And also, everyone has access to the internet now. So whatever you don't know, you can just Google. So I feel very adamant about that. It's no longer necessary to offer like a glossary at the end or anything like that. Like, we don't really need that. And I felt like it was true to who she was.
That's just what I was going to say. It really helps you understand how her mind is operating in two languages.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's how a lot of us think. And we need to be able to express that without feeling any sort of shame.
Now, tell me about some of the day jobs you had before you were able to support yourself as a writer.
Oh, God. Ooh, boy. I struggled a lot throughout my 20s. I had so many different jobs. You know, I waitressed a little bit. I worked in various offices. I had one job marketing for this print estimating, which sounds as boring as it is. Then I was in PR for a bit, and I was in a nonprofit, and I just did anything to just pay my bills because there was no other choice. Meanwhile, my dream was just to be a writer, to teach, to do both. And eventually I made that happen, but boy, it was really tough for a long time. Like, things didn't start to coalesce for me until I was in my early 30s. So yeah, I had some rough times in many, many different working environments. And I often cried in bathrooms, which is why my memoir is titled Crying in the Bathroom.
It's a great title.
Thank you.
You also got an NEA Lit Fellowship. What did that enable you to do?
Oh man, that was such a blessing. I was so grateful for that. It just really made me feel validated in many ways. And it just made my life easier to have that income and not have to worry so much about my survival. And it's something that every artist dreams of, is to just focus on the art and not have to worry about bills all the time. And so it just gave me much more freedom. I was able to go to Mexico and visit my family and do some research there about previous generations and really get a lot of information for my memoir. And so that was really exciting. Just the space to be able to write without having all of these other concerns is just such a privilege. And so I'm very happy that it allowed me to do that. And, you know, I've been so lucky throughout my career. I had the Princeton Arts Fellowship as well and some other fellowships. And just the fact that, you know, I've been given this economic advantages has just been, it's just been so important as a person who grew up poor. And it's something that, like, is hard to even explain to people from my community. Like, I get paid to write. You know, that's kind of mind-boggling for some. It still surprises me, honestly.
Well, I was just curious, what's changed for you since the great success of both your books?
I don't have to worry about a lot of things that I often did before. Like, I was always just scrambling and trying to make a living and trying to make art at the same time. And that was really, really hard. So now that my life is centered on writing and literature and teaching, it's just very, very rich. It's something that I really value. It's everything's just much easier. And I am very grateful for that. And, you know, I feel that my life is to write stories and to teach people. And that's everything I've ever wanted. So, yeah, I just feel very lucky. And I am 36 years old. I am having a child for the first time.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm due in December. And so I'm really excited about that. I'm newly married. I'm very happy. It's just the only thing that really concerns me is the rest of the world.
What are your writing practices?
Well, it varies, and I don't have like a specific schedule routine. I know a lot of writers do, and hats off to them, but I'm not like wired in that way. And so for me, the writing comes in spurts. So it just depends on what I'm working on and my teaching load, my household responsibilities, etc. And so for me, writing is always like the center of who I am. And, you know, even if I'm not actually writing, I'm reading a ton. And I think that's the most important piece of being a writer, is to be a reader. And so that's what I care about. And I write notes to myself. Sometimes I have like the jolt of inspiration and I'll like crank something out. Other times it takes me months. Right now I'm revising my memoir, and so I just cranked out one essay. I revised it this weekend and it felt amazing. I was like, oh wow, I really got that done. Yeah, it just changes.
Does teaching impact your writing?
It does. It just takes up a lot of my energy, and so I enjoy it very much. Not so much online, I will say, but I enjoy being in a classroom and talking to students and really engaging with them when it comes to literature. And it's something that brings me a lot of joy, but it's also something that I put a lot of effort into, and it does take up a lot of just my resources, you know. And so it depends. Like, if my teaching responsibilities are really intense one quarter, then I may not write as much, but it'll come.
Has the pandemic affected your writing practices or your reading?
You know, I've been reading more just because I don't have anywhere to go and I don't have to travel. And, you know, it's given me a lot of like space to be at home and with my thoughts and express myself in different ways. So I think it's been pretty fruitful for the most part. I mean, psychologically, it's been pretty challenging, but I've been actually painting and drawing and doing different kinds of like visual art and cooking. And so I've been very, very creative just to kind of cope with the circumstances. And I think that has really helped my writing as well. Art is just critical for me in every form.
And what are you working on now? What can we expect?
Well, the memoir, the revision is going to be probably a lengthy process. Hopefully not, but I mean, the fact that I'm having a baby in December is going to really change the way that I work.
So, you think?
Yeah, a little bit. And so I'm hoping that I could finish a lot of it before she gets here, but I might not. And so, yeah, it's going to be a challenge.
So you're working on a baby?
I'm working on a baby and I'm working on a book. So I was hoping to give birth to both of them at the same time, but it doesn't seem likely. Everything's been delayed because of the pandemic. The release date is not until 2022, which for me is great because I don't want to deal with this situation while I release a book. I can't even conceive of it. Like, I want to go on book tour. I want to talk to people. I want to go to events. This is just not an ideal time. And so I'm hoping by then things will look, I don't want to say normal, but better.
Yeah, no, I hear that. Well, Erica, thank you for giving me your time.
Yeah, I really appreciate your questions.
I appreciate your work and I appreciated your answers. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was writer and 2019 NEA Lit Fellow, Erica L. Sanchez. She's the author of a collection of poetry, Lessons on Expulsion, and the YA novel and the 2017 National Book Award finalist, I'm Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter. You can keep up with her at ericalsanchez.com. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Don't forget to subscribe to Artworks, and then please leave us a rating on Apple because it helps people to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.